Welcome to Imagine This Podcast,
the show where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all the excellent and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredibly vibrant arts and culture community in a new way. And we're back.
58
Another
cents.
Episode. 58 cents, everybody. That's what Dogecoin is going for. Just letting everyone know. Thank you. Thank you, David, for letting us know what Dogecoin is going for.
Gotta buy 58 cents. Because
that's
the best
way to start an episode.
My personal investment in Ethereum is almost up 100% at this point.
So that's your cryptocurrency update?
That's right. My cryptocurrency update.
I like to start the cold open.
It's up 100%.
So thanks, listeners. Now, why even bother to listen to the rest of this episode? But you will. Welcome back. Lindsay in her mind is thinking of the last week. So last week was a welcoming. And then when Lindsay started, it was just like, let's get to it. And David's start was this non sequitur about Dogecoin.
Of course it was.
So let us know, listeners, who you like. Who would you rather have open? All right.
Vote for your future cold open.
Yeah, vote for your future cold open, sir.
Hashtag, what's the hashtag? That's just our name.
Yeah, hashtag our first name cold open.
There you go.
Do it. Yeah. This is mainly directed to our bolder listeners who are like the best responders on it.
And we already know they're going to vote for you. So this is a rigged election.
But they're definitely going to want to know about their cryptocurrency price updates. That's why they're going to vote for me.
All right. So thank you, dear listeners. If you aren't fully alienated yet, let's get into it. Welcome to another issue. Because this is a magazine. Welcome to another magazine issue. Of our, this is the radio issue of Imagine This Podcast, the joyful abundance of arts and culture in Milwaukee and beyond. I'm your host, co-host Mac Antigua, also joining me, Lindsay Sheridan and David Lee.
Hey. Is this our pilot episode? What's going on?
This is our pilot episode.
Episode 25. Like,
we're just
going on
we're
right
just
now?
Anticipating that Steven is going to bring in all these new millennial listeners. It's been all the older folks, right? All of your generation. So.
All five of us.
What we know from millennials is they really like formal openings and introductions, and they like outlines. You know, they want to know what's happening.
I think I read that in an independent sector millennial report somewhere.
So dear listener, we're excited to have Steven after the break. Before we get then, or you might not know because you're new. We do like to reflect on arts and culture either at a city level, but sometimes we also like to talk about how it affects us or how we intersect with it. And that's sort of the theme for today. Right, Lindsay?
Yeah, that's right. This is here behind the scenes. This was our best writer's room draft of.
By the way, shout out to the writer's room. I think it's a great. We have so many writers that we employ to write the pod, and I just want to make
that's
sure
right.
that they get acknowledged. So thank you. Thank you to the team.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you'll hear in a little bit when we talk with Steven, he was playing in bands from a very young age, and that those life skills of improvisation and creation came to influence his political life later. And as we ask that sort of early artistic memory question of all of our guests, we get other great examples of that too, like Kendra talking about contracting her friends to be in an orchestra for her, and then she did that later in life as a career. So that got me thinking, Mac and David, if you have any stories of some sort of arts experience early in your life that then later on you look back and you go, yep, I haven't changed a bit. I am exactly who I was when I was 10 or 20 or whatever it is.
When I was 20. Last year when I was 20. I guess I'll start. One story that really comes to mind is when I, when I was in fifth grade, I was in one, I was a nerd. Still am a nerd, and I loved learning. And as a benefit, I got to be in these really cool classes that had a lot of fun learning. And one of the ways we got to learn was actually working on problem solving. In fact, there was a competition called the Future Problem Solving Bowl in Illinois, which still exists, by the way, because one of my family members competed in it. I'm like, hello, cousin. Anyway, so as a fifth grader, they would give us these situations and we were in teams and we had to respond to the situation. For example, the one that we had to work on as a team was the New Madrid fault line, which is the fault line that runs underneath Illinois, reverses the, erupts or earthquakes. I'm not from California, so I don't know how that works. But the tectonic plate shift and actually reverses course of the Mississippi River, causing damage. How do you solve it? How do you fix it? What do you do? And so as little fifth graders, we had to come up with a criteria for solutions and come up with the best solution.
Just a small question.
So a small question.
Yeah, they're depending on fifth graders to solve this problem.
That's right. Because, yeah. So my job, you're wondering, is like, wow, Mac, what was your job? One of the presentations, you had to do a presentation of your best solution. And so what I did on the team was I was the one who came up with the 10-minute skit to present what our idea was. And so, and that just came naturally to me to be thinking about, okay, how do you present this information in almost like a mini, you know, conversation and in a presentational way. And we went to the state championships that year, everybody. Just want to put that there. What's up, Palos East? Or yeah, Palos East Elementary School, shout out, District 118. We went to Illinois State University to represent because my sketch got us through, or at least was a big part of getting us through. And so I think that's still alive in me, thinking of like, how do you do a presentation in a creative way, and how do you employ a different medium, and how do you have fun?
How do you win?
How do you win?
At the end of the day, how do you win? Do you remember what your group's solution was to this tectonic plate challenge?
No. I do remember the sketch was in the form of a news, like interrupting a special news report. So I remember the format of it. And we were giving instructions to the general populace about how to react and what to do. But that's what I remember. Because I remember I had to like make the sound of da-da-da-da-da-da. Like I had to come up with the soundtrack for the...
At least it was context specific, and not, you didn't have as fifth grader Mac like program like a Dave Letterman show of like the flow of the Mississippi River due to an earthquake.
Yeah, I wish I would have thought in hindsight I would have done something Letterman-esque, since he was a big part of my upbringing. So that was my story, and I think that still resonates with me of doing that. How about you, David or Lindsay?
You know, I'll pick up on that and share a fifth grade story for me
Fifth grade story.
In fifth grade, I wrote a play and held auditions and placed people in roles and reserved the rehearsal space. And we had rehearsals for some period of time that I don't remember to prepare my play called Kubai Rots, which... was the word storybook backwards. And the premise was like, it was all like fairy tale storybook characters you knew. So it wasn't like I hadn't like created new characters. I just, you know, it was like fairy tale fan fiction, if you will. And
not
like Harry Potter fan fiction.
Not Harry Potter fan fiction.
Not Harry Potter yet. Not yet.
Hey, listeners, hashtag is if you want to read Lindsay's Harry Potter fan fiction, by the way. Hashtag at us.
That's right. Sure, it won't happen, but thanks for trying.
Yeah. Oh, it will happen.
And yeah, and the premise was that you could enter into some other world by reciting a incantation in a mirror. The incantation was also backwards, like the word coup by rods. I remember it, but I will not recite it for you now. And yeah.
But that's awful. That's so awful. How dare you? How can you do that to our listening audience?
You do a lot of these teases where you're like, oh, I had this treasure trove of Harry Potter fan fiction, which apparently one of the Weasley brothers wants to read, but you won't share it. You won't share this incantation.
For those listening home also, I just want you to know this is very much on brand with Lindsay. Whenever I host team meetings and I lead with like a check-in question, Lindsay often goes, no, I don't have an answer for that, so we're going to move on. So yeah, she just doesn't do it to you guys. She does it to me too, so...
Okay, so well, you know, anyway, I'll tell you fine. It was
yes.
Agat Ekhelp Irewa Sigum C Epper Kubai Rods. That's it. That's it backwards. It was
so
like
what
a
was
bad...
it forward? Storybook.
Yeah, what was it forward?
Go to the place where magic is real or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Go to the place where magic is
real. Anyway, the real like conclusion of that story is that I had a friend who was on the Shire side and didn't want like a big role, but she would be a understudy. So I cast her as an understudy, and the person that she was understudying for did get sick the day of the big show.
You set it up.
And
you poisoned her soup. You poisoned
she
her soup.
Had... She had memorized all the lines and she stepped in and did it. Hopefully it wasn't an empowering moment for her. I don't know.
But that person was Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah.
And you launched her career. That's awesome.
I'm not a director or a writer, but I did carry that energy into my future life. I love that.
That's so sophisticated. You had understudies. That's some serious planning. Like, somebody's gonna get sick, and we gotta be ready.
Well, and then from a story aspect, right? Like, she's got like Lindsay presaged the Tenant, basically forward backwards, you know, stuff years in advance,
ahead of the game.
Yeah,
That's awesome. That's awesome.
How about you, David?
Go to the place where magic's real, David. We need shirts. That's merch. That's merch. That's merch.
That's right.
Imagine this podcast shirts. Go to the place where that's our new tagline. Imagine this podcast. Go to the place where magic is real. And then you wear it, and then you look in a mirror, and then you're ready to go. Go ahead, David.
You know, when I was listening to Kendra on our pod a couple weeks ago, and she shared sort of her early experience, I was reminded that in college I was elected to run our campus entertainment organization, which at the time I think was one of the largest.
Where was it, David?
A little school in upstate New York called, you know, just a little small liberal arts college, Seven Sisters.
He's not going to say it.
He's not going to say it. So,
the school in which we'll not name.
the place which we will not name. That's right. I had no, that was probably my first job in the arts where, you know, I was given the power, right, to run an organization, to bring films, musical acts, and other acts to our school, to, you know, to entertain our student body. So brought the Roots. That was pretty amazing.
You
brought
the Wu-Tang
Clan. Yeah.
You booked the Wu-Tang Clan?
Yeah. And Billy Joel.
Oh man, obvious three. I put those
obvious three.
Together.
Yeah, obvious the three big ones. Just a really fun year of being able to like, you know, program the present, right, the year's entertainment for our campus. And I had no idea that back then, right, that was a job. A, that you could have that job after college, after pretend life. And then, you know, a couple weeks ago, hearing Kendra basically talk about her current job at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts, actually doing that job sort of reminded me that, you stumble into these things that you do and that there are, you know, pathways into the future for these activities.
David, I think I had a very similar role as the president of the Performing Arts Committee at my college for 2 years, and I think I was probably insufferably serious about it.
I'm surprised.
But here we are. Yeah. But here we are.
Here we are. That's right.
Well, now that we've had a chance to take a little bit of a walk down memory lane ourselves, thanks for entertaining us. Hopefully that gives you some insight into the team here. But more importantly, we're going to get to hear about Stephen Olicara and his like 50 bands that he was in growing up, ranging from klezmer to punk and like everything in between. So you're in for a really great conversation coming up. Stephen Olicara is co-founder and president of the Millennial Action Project, a national nonpartisan nonprofit org dedicated to renewing American politics through post-partisan millennial leadership. So in that role, he's activated young policymakers to bridge partisan divides. And one of those was him being the driving force behind establishing the Bipartisan Congressional Future Caucus, the nation's first millennial-led caucus in the U.S. Congress. Olicara's work has been featured on outlets a lot bigger than ours, like NBC, ABC, Al Jazeera, America, New York Times, Washington Post, etc. And impressively, he's been named the Millennial of the Year, an Aspen Ideas Scholar, and one of the most influential leaders under 40 in Washington Life magazine. After the break, Stephen Olicara.
I'm here, I'm lost.
Stephen, welcome to the pod.
My honor to be with both of you. Thanks for having me.
I'm laughing because we were just talking for 10 minutes and then I did this whole like, Stephen, welcome to the pod. And you totally were like, wait, what's going on here? That's not the person I was talking to the last.
It got serious real fast.
Yeah, no, Lindsay's like staring at
it
me.
It won't last.
He botched the open. Yeah, it got serious super fast. All right. Stephen, thanks so much for being on the pod. Honestly, as Lindsay and I were doing our homework ahead of it, we realized that, wow, he's got a lot of Google things that we got to keep up with here. So hopefully we're not going to bore you by asking you, hey, can you recall this last bit? But you've done some amazing work. And we're excited that you're part of our ecosystem here in this area. So it's really exciting. I know, I'd say personally, as someone who's grown up in the Midwest, worked in the Midwest, sometimes there's like a flyover country vibe, you know, even though there's a lot of important things that happen here that affect our whole country. And we're excited to, more importantly, talk about the intersection of arts and culture and, you know, hopefully our future of our country, you know, mostly democracy and our shared space. But
as we were learning more about you, you have all these incredible intersections between music and your political life. And we're going to get into all of that. But first, we want to invite you to think a little bit farther back in life and share with us an experience maybe early on that really impacted you in arts and culture.
Well, thanks again for having me. And as we were talking about just before we went live, I have many diverse interests and I do like moving between one and the other, but probably the earliest experience artistically that shaped me as a human being was the very first concert I performed at. And for context leading into this, I first saw a rock band perform when I was in second grade. It was a science fair that I was presenting at, and I walked outside. I'm at Burleigh Elementary School in the suburbs of Milwaukee, and I look to my right in the hallway, and I see a band performing The Offspring, Self-Esteem. And I remember that just changed my life. I remember thinking to myself, that's what I want to do. I want to be playing guitar and singing in a rock band. And so I convinced my parents to buy me a guitar. I could barely even reach the necessary, you know, strings to even play chords, but started playing in third grade. And the problem was no one else was playing rock instruments at that age. So I was mainly playing by myself. But eventually my brother, who's a drummer, he ended up forming a band. He's 3 years older than me. And I was able to convince them to let me play with them. So we're getting ready to play our first show. It's a high school battle of the bands. Keep in mind, I'm still in fifth grade here. And we're getting ready. We play. I remember a few songs from that set list. One is Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. Another one is Blink-182's All the Small Things. Keep in mind the time period as I say these songs. And I remember, you know, this is my first time performing in front of a lot of people. It's probably the most nervous I've ever been in my life. But it had such a profound experience. One, because I loved it and I really found my first passion in life, which is music and sharing music with people. But the second thing is I've actually never been as nervous as that one experience. And today, through my work, I do a lot of public speaking. I still do perform musically, but I feel like I really found a calling and a trust and a confidence in performing and in singing and generally trusting my voice. And so that was a pretty big experience.
Mm. Your brother is a drummer, right? Or done that. Did your parents already have like a musical inclination or, you know, cause it's like, all right, we'll get you a guitar. Like, was there like a secret, like thankfully found it? Or was it like, where did this come from? We only have this in this house or something. What was that like to be at home like that?
Where did this come from?
Yeah.
And that feeling was heightened probably when we had a just excruciating loud band practice coming from the basement. So yeah, no musical experience in my parents' lives growing up. We do have some distant relatives in India who played a little bit of music. So we hypothesize maybe that's where our musical gene comes from, but really no musical influence coming from my parents. It was just being caught by some live music we saw early on. And my brother, you know, it's what, you know, you were both probably familiar when you start playing music in school, you're learning largely classical music.
Yeah.
But the idea of playing the drum set or playing the electric guitar, that's something very different in a rock context. So once I saw my brother and seeing other people play that, I was like, I got to do that. In addition to playing in symphonic band in school.
I love that you're in fifth grade and you're playing in your brother's band. That's so cool of your brother to include you.
Like, it was very nice of him. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it really, so my brother got married a couple years ago and part of my best man speech was thanking him for including me because it really did change my life musically. Wow. I mean, it really started this whole journey through middle school, then high school and college and beyond, where I played in probably 15 different bands over the years of every genre and every style. But I became, you know, just reflecting on that experience, I became so comfortable with and loving the experience of performing. And so later on in life, when I introduced Barack Obama in front of 30,000 people, I was really comfortable with that. I was not nervous because I'd been on stage so much leading up to that.
See, now I was going to ask a pretty silly question, but we can't just ignore that flex. I'll ask my silly question anyway. Of those 15 bands, what was the best band name?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question. You know, one that it really depends on your genre of music and what kind of styles you're into. But honestly, the first one that comes to mind was a punk rock band called Ferocious Green that evolved into a more experimental Radiohead-esque band called New Age Noise. So that one was pretty good. I think another one that stands out to me was we had a 70s era funk band that would cover James Brown and Tower of Power, which I just saw is coming to Summerfest.
Yep,
very exciting.
Yeah.
I will be there for that for sure.
you're gonna be camped out on that part of the lawn for that.
I will be. I might be the only person under the age of 40 camped out, but I'll be very proud.
I'll see you there.
But that band name was called Bump City, which is named after a Tower of Power record and nice. A song. So yeah, we had some good ones. We definitely had some that we overthought way too much. We went into reverse dictionaries, and you know, I think the best band names are ones that just come up spur of the moment. You don't want to overthink it.
Now, Stephen, I mean, you've founded and led the Millennial Action Project, which is about political engagement and civic engagement. But I have to stand this. You've been in 15 bands. What has that taught you about politics, being in 15 different bands? And like you said, the decision-making process of naming yourselves and all the micro decisions and things. I'd welcome micro stories, or are there like just as you look on the balcony, here are the things I would weave together about what I took from that into thinking about what does it mean to act politically, right? Or have a shared governance and these notions of society.
Yeah, you know, Mac, it's everything. I mean, it shaped every aspect from the entrepreneurial journey of how you organize disparate band members, get on the same page, rehearse, play shows, record, get gigs, to the softer, intangible skills that actually end up being really important to your leadership and ultimately the atmosphere and vibe created in really good musical spaces that I think are the highest expression of our democracy. So I'll share maybe the one experience that shaped me the most, which was my first day at jazz camp at the Conservatory of Music here. And I remember walking in just so excited to play and learn jazz. And that's really the mentality of all the musicians. You just can't wait to play. And immediately the instructor says, put your instruments away. And we're thinking, why? And he says, we're just going to sit here and listen. In jazz, I think maybe more than any other style of music I've been around, it's been about listening and really understanding not only the genre, but your fellow musicians. And, you know, I say that jazz is a call and response art form in the same way that our democracy should be a call and response political system. And there are other skills too, like improvisation and jazz. It's about being live, fully present, interacting with people, bringing your full self to the conversation. That's really what we need in our political engagement today. It's not about leaving our principles and beliefs at the door. It's bringing our full identity so we can have a honest and truthful conversation about how we can move forward together. And I think the other one aspect of this eclectic musical background that really stands out to me is just the diversity of genres. So, you know, each genre, just to give the listeners a sense. So in addition to the punk rock and experimental rock bands I also played in multiple jazz groups. I had a hip hop band inspired by The Roots that had a turntables guy and a breakdancer. Like, you really can't make this stuff up. We had a folk band that was sort of like a Joni Mitchell type of outfit. We had the funk band I was mentioning earlier. And then on top of that, we had a Jewish klezmer band called the Red Squares. You know, that might have been the best band name now that I think about it. The Red Squares. We had maybe the best album cover, which was a photo of all of us superimposed into a Russian cathedral. So, you know, we watched Dr. Zhivago in high school, and clearly that really influenced us. But then we got into Yiddish music and klezmer. And so... you know, the thing about all these genres is they tap into different subcultures in my case, the greater Milwaukee area. Mm-hmm. And so when you consider just how racially and politically segregated this metro area is, music was that rare force that mm-hmm. could bridge and reconcile some of these stark divisions in our community. And on top of that, I found that maybe this was the most fundamental lesson learned that shaped my future political DNA, is that when our bandmates would come together, and we were the most motley crew band, set of bandmates you can imagine, along with the convergence of our audiences, multiracial, multireligious, all kinds of different political backgrounds, I realized that the art got better. The music was more original, more dynamic. And I realized that when you can create these spaces rooted in compassion and openness and listening, it's truly an evolutionary process. And so the ethos of my politics today really is about how we can find that higher vibration of conversation that allows us to not split the difference between our differing ideas, but rather move to an entirely new space. So it's more of an evolutionary process. And so I fundamentally believe in the politics of empathy and humanity and bridge building, because I think that's what's needed for a democracy to survive. So that those are some of the bigger lessons there.
You know, what I was taken by Stephen is that the words and framing you're using are inviting people to go to a different place. If that makes sense, right? And if I were to be maybe glib or crass, which I often am, right, it could be seen as soft in some way, right? However, I also think that what you're inviting people is to step into their vulnerability of who they are. And yeah. And could we actually have a space that invites people to be their full vulnerabilities? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, that's really hard today. Or we have not allowed ourselves collectively as a society to have those places publicly, like Twitter, like this, you make a mistake on Twitter. It could be a dumb mistake. Oh boy. Yeah. Right. There's more than enough people, you know, and I think that's what I was chewing on. Like everything you're saying, I'm vibing on, I'm listening deeply. And I'm what I'm wondering, and I'm wondering your reaction to is like, what would it take to set up those spaces? Because I'm with you as an individual. I see that I'm there, but I also wonder what would it take for that to be, for more people to have that trust, or maybe you've seen examples of that happen, you know, in micro processes, right. And maybe smaller examples of that, because that's what I'm hearing you say is like, and you've even had things like Meet in the Middle, right. You've had projects about Meet in the Middle, and for me to come to the middle means I have to be vulnerable and show up. But I think there's something about our current 2021 that makes it shoot pandemic. We got to wear masks. Like there's even physical things. Yeah. How does that vibe for you, Stephen? Yeah. Or maybe I'm like crazy. I don't know. And that's why I was super quiet. I was just chewing on all that. But
and I want to just add for me as well, what resonated is it's a really apt metaphor, right? You can put on all these performances of different styles, but you might end up attracting the audience that only really enjoys klezmer and isn't willing to go out of their klezmer attending bubble. So it's a perfect metaphor. So just wanted to add that to the mix of, yeah, setting up the space for people to show up fully and then getting them there. What's the tie?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the klezmer example. I mean, some of our biggest fans were from outside of the Jewish community. In addition to the Jewish community, we had a full page ad in the Milwaukee Jewish Chronicle, which was really our high point as a band. And I think one of the essential things is how you curate a space and the frame of the discussion and the overall vibe of it. I mean, leaders have a huge role to play in setting up a constructive conversation. And so one example I could share is for 2 years, we did a series across Wisconsin called Red and Blue Dialogues. and was all about trying to attack that exact issue, Mac, that you mentioned. How do you create a vulnerable space where there's more curiosity and less prejudgment? And also to challenge the notion that we can't even come together to have a conversation. And when I would hear from people who are uber liberal or uber conservative, frankly, a lot of people don't even like these labels, right? You know, my favorite was meeting, he's a local brewery owner here who identifies as, you know, libertarian and socialist and has maybe tendencies of both. And so how can you create a conversation that is not seeing the other person as the enemy right away? And so we did that. We would create these discussions. And one thing that was essential to that was the pre-dialogue conversation we would have at the top, which would model the type of political discourse we want to see. So we would have a local Republican, a local Democrat, myself moderating, and maybe a couple of thought leaders on the issue we're focusing on. It could be criminal justice reform or energy and the environment or higher education, water stewardship. And that set the tone of the subsequent conversation. The second thing that was important was having trained facilitators. So we partnered with the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion here in Milwaukee. They lent their expertise to us so we could have these conversations that don't vilify people for maybe having a different view. And then the other thing that was important was when you're sitting next to a human being and hearing a background story of how they came to a certain view, that activates your sense of empathy. And so when you add all of this up, my favorite story was this. We were at the Bavarian Beer House talking about criminal justice reform and had maybe the widest spectrum of voices we had at any of these events. A uber liberal activist comes up to me afterwards and she says, Stephen, I just want to share, I really enjoyed the discussion, but there was just one problem at my table. And I said, ma'am, thank you for saying that. What was the issue you found? And she said, I just felt like we were agreeing with each other way too much. And I asked her, well, you know, that's really helpful feedback. And also, did you know that you're sitting next to the local head of the Republican Party? And to the other side, you're sitting next to one of the leaders of a very conservative group that does care about criminal justice reform, but you maybe never have sat next to. And she's thinking to myself, wow, like, I didn't realize how much I was agreeing with the quote unquote enemy, right? And so that experience changed her life, and she kept coming back. And there are others who kept coming back because there's a positive feeling that comes out of these conversations. And there's research that shows we feel better about ourselves, or we have better health, our immune systems are better when we're approaching political conversations with compassion as opposed to contempt. And so I think this is a real awakening that is on the verge of being a much larger movement. And we just have to get it out there more.
Well, and the vision you're sharing is from your perspective, a generational perspective as well. And you've harnessed that for your work in founding the Millennial Action Project. So I'm curious, given the urgency of the issues that we've had today, the recent election, the insurrection, the pandemic, Black Lives Matter, can you speak more about how some of these, how I think millennials are uniquely positioned to lead the charge on addressing these just really stark trends and inequities?
There's a huge opportunity with young people today, not only millennials, Generation Z. Now young people of those generations are increasingly not only voters and advocates, but elected officials as well. And so the real question that I see now is, how is this generation going to lead our country? Are we going to tap into this common humanity mindset, or are we going to continue down the path of greater hatred and contempt and dehumanization, which I think is really the hallmark of our a lot of our politics today. And so that's the big choice we have. And I see two huge opportunities with young people today. So one reason why Millennial Action Project focuses on younger leaders is simply because I think as a theory of change, that's one of the best ways you can change the future is train young leaders who are really at the beginning of their public service, in some cases just getting elected. And so how can we provide a positive reinforcement around collaboration, around humanity and dignity, and bridge building, and help facilitate building coalitions so there can be real change, like real legislation getting passed. And so in some ways it was saying, you know, investing in young people is a really smart investment to make. And you see that in the art space as well. I think one of the most important things you can do is invest in arts education for young people. And so that's one big part of it. The second is you are seeing some unique qualities with the younger generation right now. If you look at the longer term trends, these younger generations are the least partisan in our entire country, and yet are most focused on the issues. So, for example, mm-hmm. our generation cares the most about environmental causes and combating climate change. And yet we're approaching it in a nonpartisan way. It's, in other words, we care more about the issues than we do about partisan politics. Mm-hmm. You have a rise of independent affiliations right now among young people as well. So that's a huge opportunity. I think that might be partly the response to what we've seen growing up. I mean, we've, through all of our formative experiences, we haven't really seen government and politics work well. And so we're kind of critiquing not just the individual players, but the system as a whole. And so I think we have this healthy disregard for the status quo. And so with our leaders, we have over 1,600 young elected leaders across the country involved in our organization. From across the political spectrum, they say yes to conversation and yes to learning where each other is coming from, and no to this politics of hatred. And, you know, it's not always perfect, and no leader is perfect. But I do think we're headed in that direction. And I think young people, historically too, have been the leading force in transforming American politics, whether you look at the civil rights movement, where it's a 25-year-old John Lewis who's walking across the bridge in Selma, a 26-year-old Dr. King who's leading the Montgomery bus boycott, or even if you look at the founding of this country, the majority of the founding fathers were actually under the age of 40. We sometimes forget with their powdered wigs and all of that, but you know, there's a long history. Look at the women's rights movement as well, a long history of young people transforming politics.
Mm. You know, as you're speaking, Stephen, that noticing of young people are paying attention, yet they're not necessarily supportive or engaged with the current vehicles that are in front of them. And there's exactly. something of a party politics, right? And I think of the work of local academic Julia Azari at Marquette. You know, I follow her and her blog, The Mischiefs of Faction, where she does a lot of research on the notion of, like, what is the point of parties on some level, mm-hmm. right? And I think, you know, your comrade raised for me, like, I think when I think about that, and maybe I'm not reading it totally, maybe I'm just enough to be dangerous, but I'm thinking about the use of utility of political parties is around organizing large groups of people and large groups of resources to win elections. However, there is a wondering, is that maybe effective for that, but how effective is it for governing and for people to feel more consistently engaged outside of these every 4-year quadrennial experiences or every 6-year yeah. things? And what I'm hearing you say, Steve, is like, maybe young people are really hungry for a way to be engaged that maybe the party system currently isn't offering. And some of them are taking office themselves. That's a way in, but that's not everybody's ability to do yeah. that, because you have to have a certain one, confidence in oneself to take on that role, but also access to resourcing and time to put yourself out there and do that. So I'm just sort of wondering, you know, are you seeing something emerge? And again, I know this is an arts and culture blog. I'm wondering, are there arts and culture solutions, if you will, to allow the organizing, if you will, that parties are currently doing, but may, you know, alternative ways? Because again, the party system is only getting us to this point, I think, right? Of red versus blue, if you will, of teams and, you know, I don't know if any of the stuff's making sense. I'm just trying to
absolutely
parse out. I'm doing a sense make as I'm hearing you.
I think you're getting into the nuances of the political system right now that we do need to talk about. And so as you're speaking about, there are helpful attributes of parties, and major reforms in the course of American history have largely been through major parties. If you consider the progressive era in the early 20th century that really took hold here in Wisconsin, that was largely led by leaders in the Republican Party, people like Fighting Bob La Follette. And you see people like Gaylord Nelson, for example, a Democratic U.S. senator who founded Earth Day. And so you have opportunities to reform the political system even within the two parties. And yet the research you're referencing is true as well. George Washington warned us of the mischiefs of faction in his farewell address. He said it would lead to this kind of revenge-seeking behavior. So how do you get the best of both worlds? And I think artists actually have the solution here. I think artists, artists in general, as a way of being, are speaking to something that's deeply in our soul. They're expressing feelings. That's one reason why I am very active as a songwriter. You see this guitar. I write a lot of songs on this guitar here. Because I think there are things you can communicate artistically on a deeper level that also connect with people emotionally that maybe traditional political rhetoric might not be able to do. And so I think what artists do generally is really push the envelope, push our society to see what the future can be, while also speaking to the deep struggles that are in our hearts. And what that means and what that offers us as a society is a humanizing of our dialogue. And so I believe at this moment right now, like we have a two-party system right now. Who knows where we'll be 15, 20 years from now. But right now, I think the reason why Millennial Action Project works largely with Democrats and Republicans, as well as there's some independents out there, is because that's where we are right now. But also, you have artists that can help to change the atmosphere of our political conversations and who can, in many ways, lead by example, too, by forging collaborations that maybe aren't already happening in the political space. So I'll give a great example of this. In the 1950s, you had jazz musicians pushing the country on racial challenges. And you know, you had jazz musicians far ahead of the curve on racial integration. So you consider the legendary collaboration between Miles Davis and Bill Evans, two people who had very different experiences growing up racially and in other ways. And yet they formed this bond, produced Kind of Blue, which I think is the highest selling jazz record ever. And they were integrating their audiences at the same time. And so in many ways, art has always had this relationship with politics. And I think it's largely a positive one.
You know, hearing more about the series of conversations you hosted and thinking about the great value in showing up to a literal physical shared space together and not necessarily knowing the labels of the people beside you, and how that you can have that experience when you're showing up at a table where, like you said, she didn't necessarily know she was sitting next to the head of the Republican Party in the area. Or you show up to a concert and you're anonymous in some way, but you're connected by this shared interest in what is on stage. And I guess I'm just bringing that up to think through, you know, what has the last year done to us in terms of not being able to have those physical shared experiences when we're already in such a polarized place where, you know, the digital culture is so toxic compared to that opportunity to show up in a more open space in person. And I wonder what some of your first takes are about how are we going to repair that moving forward? Yeah.
I mean, I would argue that at least in my lifetime, we're the most polarized and most isolated that we've ever been. And there's certainly data on polarization and that backs that up. I'm curious if there are any studies on isolation as well. But my sense is when you look at the rise of social media and how that affects people psychologically, you are seeing increasing levels of depression and isolation. The pandemic, as you mentioned, just amplifies those trends as well. So my sense is we're in a really tough place right now because of that. And you layer other compounding factors like economics, for example. A lot of people in low-wage work right now have lost their jobs or they're barely making enough money. So you have that added stress as well while people are kind of sitting at home too much. So what I'm hopeful for is this summer and what's going to happen after this. I do believe there's going to be an even greater hunger for human connection. We just saw the lineup of Summerfest announced. We're getting back to having live music, and I work with a number of live music organizations in town as well that are really excited about getting these performances on the calendar. And I think people are just going to be really hungry to get back out there and have this sense of connection. And here's where it ties to politics in a positive way. My gut instinct is that people are going to be hungry for more human connection in their politics as well. Connection across lines of difference. And when you referenced the insurrection earlier, you know, I serve on the board of some human rights organizations abroad, and I'm always reminded of how quickly this experiment in diverse democracy can unravel. And political violence now is very real. It's a real thing in front of us that that in many ways is the natural conclusion of a system that profits on all of this hateful thinking and rhetoric. So I think we're at a real inflection point. If we can come out of this pandemic, not only with an interest in reconnecting with our neighbors, reconnecting with the live music, but also with reconnecting with humanity in our politics, that's going to be a huge, huge opportunity. But I think it only happens if we have leaders who are willing to call and summon that spirit as well.
You know, and Stephen, as you're talking, it can feel very overwhelming in the sense of you're talking about, you know, Lindsay's thinking about, you know, societal scale. But what I'm also gathering from you, Stephen, or intuiting, or perhaps I'm projecting and hoping, who knows, we'll see, spin the wheel, see what it is. This can be done in really micro ways. Every moment is an opportunity to practice that and be it. And what if we all could practice that in some way consistently, these human connections, these moments of grace, these willingness to step in other people's shoes, which again, arts and culture accelerate that immensely, then we can start to turn like a battleship, to use that analogy, slowly our ship of state. Look at me being clumsy with these things, but you know, but there's something about that, right? Am I intuiting what you're right, Stephen? Like, all is not lost, right? We have even with Summerfest this fall, let's go. You know, like, these are ways that collectively, if we can pay better attention in these moments, we can begin to repair, you know, if not repair, build something anew. That wasn't.
This is such an important point that I try and emphasize with all the events we've done with the Millennial Action Project. It's the individual power that we have to create a collective change. So you're exactly right.
Course, Stephen, of course I'm exactly right. Thank you for noticing.
Exactly right.
Thank you for noticing, exactly Stephen. Right. Good. That's what we have you on. Thanks for noticing. Go ahead.
Every day we have a choice to make. And if we can, yes, it's such a large problem, but we do have agency to change the atmosphere in our daily conversations and to choose empathy every day. And I often liken this choice to muscle building. Like, if you're training for any kind of athletic experience, you have to put in the time and really build up that muscle. And ultimately, some things can become like muscle memory. And I think empathy is like a muscle that we need to build over time. And so that starts with our individual daily practices. And here's the cool thing too. I strongly believe that we're all connected as human beings, that we all have energy that flows through us. And so when we make that choice, it's not only affecting us, which is great, but it's also affecting the other people around us. And in that sense, it affects all the people around them. So in other words, it's a ripple effect. And so if we, you know, think about like a daily act of kindness where you just like hold the door open for someone, or you just, you're nice to someone you meet on the street. You have no idea what kind of impact that could have on that person and the other people they talk to that day. So, you know, Bobby Kennedy had this great line about ripples of hope, you know? So if we unleash these ripple of hopes, it can become a larger force that ultimately changes society.
You know, that on that spectrum of these global problems to the individual solutions we can take each day, we also think that here at Imagine that that we have some potential to really lead a future for Milwaukee that is more arts driven, more equitable. And in doing so, that I think also that Milwaukee can be an example for the rest of the country. And so with that transition, Where there so you go. Good. We have we like to bestow this imaginary power. Max says it's not imaginary, but
it's not imaginary. It's real. It's real.
In full transparency, it only lasts a few minutes. You know, not the same level of political power that that you might want, but we offer the opportunity to pretend you're the city's czar of arts and culture for a few minutes. Mm. What is the first policy that you'd pass to benefit Milwaukee?
Oh, great question, Lindsay. I like this one a lot. So, well, you know, my thing is, I'm thinking on a city level. So, I mean, there are two things that stand out to me. One is the arts are generally underfunded, I think, in our schools and in our society in general. It's not just the in-school stuff. It's also what are the opportunities in parks and in other local venues for artistic engagement. That I think needs to be increased dramatically, because it's not just about the arts. It's also about all the other disciplines, whether it's engineering or science and math, that benefits from artistic engagement in a community. So important art economically as well, because if the state of Wisconsin is going to be successful over the long term, we have to attract young people to live and work here. And see entrepreneurial opportunities, and arts and culture has a huge impact. And so I think we need to probably just shed more light on, as I know you already are, on the value of the creative economy. So that would be one thing. The second, maybe a little crazier idea, is that I really think there needs to be more... basically more rock and roll at a younger age.
Stephen, of all the things you said on this interview, you were really like patient on that one. Like you were really careful. You're like, oh, let me, I don't know, man. This could end that interview right now. This could end me.
Like, it wasn't as shocking as
everything else was almost like super smooth stumped. Like he gets this, he's not, but I'm like, I don't know if I should say this. More rocking. You're like more rocking earlier.
We got to rock out at a younger age.
You got
to
rock the cradle. You got to rock this thing earlier. Tell me more. Yeah. Tell us more.
Well, absolutely. I just think that, you know, young. There are a few benefits to rocking out at a younger age. So one is that at a really important stage in children's development, I think it's really important that like people embrace their uniqueness and what makes them original. And I think that's what rock and roll is basically all about. And so I think if you're more exposed to that lifestyle and that music, that has a huge impact on young people who maybe feel left out. They feel like an outsider in the environment they're growing up in. But then musically, I think it's hugely important too, because so many people want to, I think, communicate through music at a young age. And, you know, and I love, I've played classical music for decades, and it's an amazing art form. But it's largely kind of one way, in that you are reading off of sheet music and then communicating that to the audience. And then usually at a, you know, at a symphony concert, there's not a ton of feedback coming from the audience until the end of the performance. You know, at a rock and roll show, I mean, you're talking about immediate energy flow transferring from the musicians to the audience. It just flexes that communication muscle at an earlier age. And honestly, I think will spark a greater interest in music in young people as well. So like the whole school of rock concept, why isn't that real? Mm-hmm. Like we can make that real if our leaders make that choice.
So it's not just rock music. You'd be open to EDM at a younger age. You'd be open to ska. You're not limiting to like two guitar, you know, bass guitar, rhythm guitar.
Exactly.
I just want to be clear. Like you're open to...
I'm open to everything, and I remember getting into ska music when I was in middle school. I remember being made fun of it for that, being into ska music. Yeah, exactly. I mean, right. Hey, ska is actually really important because you have people, think about it, in grade school who are playing trombone, who are playing saxophone, but all of a sudden you can be playing in a rock band as well with those horns.
Yeah,
that's awesome. That's a great invitation.
Look at you bring it. You're expanding the tent, Steve. It's like, hey, I got to speak to my trombone people, my baritone horns. There's a place for you. Love it. Steve, what a lovely conversation. I know I'm energized to go find that, you know, that Specials album that I guess now that I've been keeping away now that you reminded me of Scott. How can folks find you to either continue the conversation or stay up on your work or your organization's work? How can they find you?
Yeah, definitely. So Millennial Action Project is millennialaction.org. Or if you want to keep in touch with me, with everything I'm doing with MAP, but also creatively in the community, just find me on social media at Stephen Olicara on Twitter and Instagram.
Great. Stephen,
and
thanks so
tuned.
Much. Stay tuned. Stay tuned. Oh, stay tuned?
Stay
wait,
tuned.
Wait. Stay tuned for what? Stay tuned for what?
Stephen, I share something?
In general, stay tuned.
Okay.
What's coming next?
Did you declare something on our pod? I don't want to hold back from something, but
I was gonna say, stay tuned for my performance up in Door County in August. I'll be playing a show
there
up there.
Okay, I had made it for some other time, but you're telling me you're gonna be up at the Peninsula State Park rocking out.
Yeah. You know, one of the best things I've done is I've driven across the state, basically setting up in parks like that, playing music with various musicians over the years, and it's been awesome. We do have an EP that is completed. We were going to do a summer tour across Wisconsin last summer, so we're likely going to do it this summer. So awesome. Stay tuned for that, awesome. As well as some other announcements on the horizon as well.
There it is.
And thanks for being so graceful. You said you'd answer anything. Thanks, Stephen.
Of course.
And we look forward to hearing about you in Door County, as well as any other news that may come up. We look forward to hearing that. Until then.
Thank you.
Stephen, thanks for being on the pod.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Man, that was a lot of fun. I really love Stephen's energy. I really thought we were going to break some news.
I was just thinking that too.
Oh my gosh, we were so
that would have been our biggest moment yet.
That would have been our biggest scoop.
Yeah.
But that being said, let's not take away from the previous 30 minutes we talked to them. I am hopeful. One, I'm very glad he's taken the path that he has, because it really resonates with me, the role of how arts is a massive code switcher. It's a massive bridge builder. And it's something we desperately need now to be in connection with each other as we move through these really difficult, ambiguous times.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really great to hear how he leads, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, I agree. And it's exciting also to think about someone with his potential ambitions representing us and so fully understanding the importance of arts and culture.
Yes, that's what I'm excited about too. Whatever role he's going for and thinking about, looking forward to hearing about how we can continue to partner and make sure that arts and culture, like the sun and like the water, is accessible and bountiful and plentiful for all of us here in Milwaukee and the county.
Hey, yes. By the way, the transition music you've been hearing throughout this episode and will hear coming out of this is Stephen himself. Very yes. Rarely do we get to have a guest on and ask them for transition music. So that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, usually we have to settle for my scat singing. Mm-hmm. And I'm so mm-hmm. thankful that we have a much better option, which is the music of Stephen Olicara. And looking forward to hearing more. You know who I'm looking forward to hearing from, Lindsay?
Who, Mac?
Our listeners.
Yeah.
Because you all are growing and you all are amazing, and so we're so grateful for you listening and continuing to share the pod with others, and so if you enjoy this, let's keep it rolling, baby. Support the pod, share with it with others, post about it on social, leave a rating and review, or contact us directly at pod@imaginenke.org.
Imagine This podcast is a team effort produced, edited, and hosted by Lindsay Sheridan MacArthur Antigua and David Lee, and is the flagship of the Imagine MKE podcast network.
Make sure you also listen and subscribe to Black Imagination, as well as listen to back episodes of Arts Forward MKE, all of which can be found at imaginemke.org/podcasts.
To catch all the latest from Imagine MKE, hit us up at Twitter and Instagram at @imagine_MKE or on Facebook or LinkedIn. It's just search Imagine MKE. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next Tuesday.
Till Tuesday, voices carry.
It's a thing now.
I'm always thinking of bits. I'm always looking. Mining. I'm crypto mining. Sure. Crypto mining for bits.
For Dogecoin, the Dogecoin of bits.
Has Dogecoin hit a dollar yet?
I don't know.
I'm thinking about buying.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
You missed our whimsy when we played Password, David. We played Password.
It was very good. Mac made up the whole game.
Do you know the game Password, David? Where it builds up to a thing. An overall thing.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is easy. Somebody on the internet's created,
way of doing progressive
so
password.
I had to invent, and so like the hardest thing for me is like, what is a common touch point that Lindsay, Antoine, Esteban would know? And so my thing was Elon Musk was my like super clue was Elon Musk. And like the first clue, David, I'll give it to you. I'll see if you can guess it. Oh, shoot.
He already knows what the answer is.
No, like the first level. This is the first level. Okay, here, David. Lindsay said Edison, right? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd say?
Light bulb.
Okay. And then I said innovator. And you'd say?
Tesla.
Okay. So keep that. We did that for like 30 minutes, by the way. That first
that
word.
That first one. It was inventor.
It was inventor. But about like, and at that moment, I'm like, oh God, we're not good at this game. This is going to be rough. But it turned out all right. And the odd thing was, I think Esteban had actually guessed Elon Musk in one of the earlier clues. Like it ended up like, anyway. Mm-hmm. Or he said Tesla or something. All right. Anyway, go ahead. Moving on. Password. We did password. There you go. Dogecoin, Elon Musk.
So wait, was Dogecoin one of the...
No, it was the clues were inventor, boring, space, Tesla. Oh, no, Grimes. I did Grime because that's his wife's name, Grimes.
That was... Yeah. I had no idea. Yeah.
No, it's a minor one. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. The last clue was Tesla. And then I was like, oh, Elon Musk.
Anywho...
All right, let's record this thing.